This recording is of a Rethinking Revolution seminar in Shrewsbury, recorded 7th of April 2010. The topic is, how do we know who will struggle? The left talks a lot about class, but in a manner that often confuses more than it clarifies. The speaker, Paul Bowman, wonders just how useful the classification-obsessed approach of the left actually is. After the talk, there was about 30 minutes of discussion. The meeting was organised by the WSM. You'll find more files from the WSM at www.wsm.ie.
The thing about social theory is, because it's not like physics or chemistry or so on, it's very difficult because you're dealing with inherently complex sort of components. You're talking about humans, you're talking about how humans add up together to be a society. So it's very difficult to actually prove things or disprove things one way or another. So it's actually hard to say if, you know, a social theory or a social category is true or not in some absolute sense. The question then is it useful? And that's probably the best question that we can ask of any social concept, your class, society, anything else. How useful is it? And more to the point is, how useful it is in the abstract is one thing, but can I make use of it? Or can any of the people that I'm working with make use of it? What can we do with this concept? Rather than arguing theologically as if you were about angels on the heads of pins. Now, I'm not going to explain these, I'm just going to start off with a couple of quotes, just for fun, which will sort of, the relevance of which will become clear a little bit later on, hopefully. So the first one is from Malatesta in the having a debate with comrade Per Manat in Amsterdam, 1907, about syndicalism. Manat is expressing the belief that after the Charter of Amiens, syndicalism is the way for working class people to organize. Therefore, as anarchists are in favor of working class liberation, people should just dissolve the anarchist movement and go into working in syndicalism. Malatesta disagrees. Then he says, the basic error of Monat and all revolutionary syndicalists, in my opinion, derives from an overly simplistic concept of the class struggle. It is a conception whereby the economic interests of all workers, of the working class, are held to be equal, whereby it's enough for the workers to set about defending their own particular interests in order for the interests of the whole proletariat against the bosses to be defended. The reality is very different, in my view. The workers, like the bourgeoisie, like everyone, are subject to the law of universal competition that derives from the system of private property, and that will only be extinguished together with that system. Key point of passage. There are therefore no classes in the proper sense of the term, because there are no class interests. There exists competition and struggle within the working class, just as there does among the bourgeoisie. The economic interests of one category of worker are implacably in contrast with those of another category. And indeed, we sometimes see workers much closer economically and mentally to the bourgeoisie than to the proletariat. So, that's Malatesta. In a very different era, the English historian E.P. Thompson, having recently left the Communist Party, writing a book called Making the Working Classes, comes out with this quote, which, although it is quite long, I'm going to... Someone get me some water? I'm going to stick with it because I think it expresses a lot of the ideas that I'm going to be trying to introduce, but does so in fairly plain language, which is a bit of an achievement in this field. So, by class, I understand an historical phenomenon unifying a number of disparate and seemingly unconnected events, both in the raw material of experience and in consciousness. I emphasize that it is an historical phenomenon. I do not see class as a structure, nor even a category, but as something which in fact happens and can be shown to have happened in human relationships. More than this, the notion of class entails the notion of a historical relationship. Like any other relationship, it is a fluency which evades analysis if we attempt to stop it dead at any given moment and anatomize its structure. The finest mesh sociological net cannot give us a pure specimen of class any more than it can give us one of deference or of love. The relationship must always be embodied in real people and in a real context. Moreover, we cannot have two distinct classes, each with an independent being, and then bring them into relationship with each other. We cannot have love without lovers, nor deference without squires and labors. And class happens when some men, as a result of common experiences, inherited or shared, feel and articulate the identity of their interests as between themselves and as against other men whose interests are different from and usually opposed to theirs. The class experience is largely determined by the productive relations into which men are born or enter involuntarily. Class consciousness is the way in which these experiences are handled in cultural terms, embodied in traditions, value systems, ideas, and institutional forms. If the experience appears as determined, class consciousness does not. We can see a logic in the responses of similar occupational groups undergoing similar experiences, but we cannot predicate any law. Consciousness of class arises in the same way in different times and places, but never in just the same way. There is today an ever-present temptation to suppose that class is a thing. This was not Marx's meaning in his historical writing, yet the error vitiates much latter-day so-called Marxist writing. It, in quotes, the working class is assumed to have a real existence, echoes Malatesta here, which can be defined almost mathematically. So many men who stand in a certain relation to the means of production. Once this is assumed, it becomes possible to deduce the class consciousness which it ought to have, but seldom does have, if it was properly aware of its own position and real interests. There is a cultural superstructure through which this recognition dawns in inefficient ways. These cultural lags and distortions are a nuisance, so that it is easy to pass from this to some theory of substitution, the party, sect, or theorist who disclose class consciousness not as it is, but as it ought to be. And then skipping to the final bit from Thompson goes, if we remember that class is a relationship and not a thing, we cannot think this way. It does not exist. Either to have an ideal interest or consciousness, or to lie as a patient on the adjuster's table. So, final quote before I start talking again is from Italy, 1971, and from Mario Tronti. We too have worked with a concept that puts capitalist development first and workers second. This is a mistake. And now we have to turn the problem on its head, reverse the polarity, and start again from the beginning. And the beginning is a class struggle of the working class. At the level of socially developed capital, capitalist development becomes subordinated to working class struggles. It follows behind them, and they set the pace to which political mechanisms, capital's own reproduction, must be tuned. In June 1848, the working class took over the stage, and they have never left it since. In different periods, they have voluntarily taken on different roles, as actors, as prompters, as technicians or stagehands, whilst all the time waiting to wade into the theater and attack the audience. Tronti in typical Italian style. Taxonomy, or rather, let's start with the popular meanings of class when people use the terms in everyday conversation. I mean, I'm sure you've heard people say of another person bitching about them, like, fucking middle class. Why? What does that mean? What is someone saying when they say that? It means that the person saying it, thinking like the person they're saying it about, has a certain set of attitudes or beliefs or behaviors that come from a relatively privileged background. So you've got consciousness, you've got culture, you've got a sort of link to some kind of material basis of, like, they had an easy life, maybe they don't understand what it's like not having any money, that sort of thing. But that's sort of in common parlance. We're mainly talking about people. And obviously when we're talking about people, we're talking about the way they think, the way they behave. So it's quite a heavily subjective idea. That's actually not a million miles away from a lot of what sociology does. Sociology tries to put that on a more scientific, if you like, footing. Now, I have to apologize, my colleague who's a sociologist who's going to be giving the other side of this is not here, so this is a bit one-sided, because I am not a sociologist. That is to say, we're actually looking at people and we're trying to categorize them, trying to give them some kind of taxonomy, not necessarily related on their appearance, but related on their income, where they live, what job they do, and that sort of thing. So we have something like this. This is not a particularly sociological thing. This came out of the National Reading Survey thing. But you'll see in newspaper articles and so on, people still talk about these A, B, C, 1, C, 2s, Ds, and so on. And although sociologists don't use it anymore, marketing people use it a lot. You know, marketing is very important. Look, trying to segment your market, find out what income the people you have you're trying to sell to and what their interests might be. So this is their way of looking at social class, if you like. It's very much a category, taxonomy-based thing. This one is this is by Experian, who are one of the two big credit raters in Western Europe and in America. You can't actually read this. I just include this because it makes me laugh. And they use this to categorize areas where they're going to do mail shots and stuff. So at the top, you have top group symbols of success. Lots of subcategories: cultural connections, cultural leadership, corporate chieftains, golden empty nesters, provincial privilege, high technologists. You have typical names: Rupert and Felicity.
Have we got any Rupert or Felicity?
No, that would be fun. And then further down the scale, we have urban intelligence, Ben and Chloe, mixture of middle classes. Then we're getting down to welfare, borderline, municipal dependency, blue collar, rural isolation, twilight subsistence. You can see that this is the kind of class structure which a credit rating industry would give you. It's very suited to their purposes, but there's still a lot of these sort of things that exist in the literature, this idea that class is a layer of strata, that you have from top to bottom, you have these layers. And that basically the basic relationships are basically one is above the other, one is below the other. But that's about it. Otherwise, what defines them is, you know, like the butterflies, how big they are, what color they are, how much money they have, that sort of thing. I'm presenting to you an alternative idea that's not a very useful way of looking at class. Basically because of this lack of a relationship thing. Don't mention the war. For me, class, a more interesting way of looking at class is to start with the relationship that exists between classes that actually creates the classes, which is the conflict. To a certain extent, if there wasn't a conflict there, there wouldn't really be any classes. You have lots of identities, lots of cultural tribes, people who dress different, listen to different music, and so on and so forth. But there wouldn't really be class as we understand it. So, now, I'm going to have to introduce some of the slightly over the... This is the sort of thing that E.P. Thompson is able to do without using terms like this. What is a thing, not a thing? How can both Malatesta in 1907 and E.P. Thompson in 1963 go like, let's start by talking about class by saying that it doesn't exist? That seems a bizarre thing to say, a strange way to start. So, we've already talked a little bit about the difference between relations and things. So there's two ways of looking at the world. You can look at the world in terms of things. Here are squares, here are tables, blah, blah, blah. And then once you've decided what your things are, then you can decide what the relationship. Well, the table is over there. The chart is over here. So you have this universe of things appear, and then secondarily they enter into relationship with each other. But the flip side of that, the other way of looking at the world, is to start with the relationship and to say, okay, we have spatial relationships are not great relationships, but the relationship between an acorn, a sapling, and a tree. We say, okay, these are all obviously linked, and one of them is going to become another one, and so on and so forth. And the other thing is, which brings us on to the steady state and the dynamic process. In the world of Euclidean mathematics, things exist, or Platonic forms, things exist as they are. You know, a triangle has three sides, and it doesn't have three sides today. It had it yesterday. It's always had three sides. It always will have three sides. The fact that it's a triangle means that it is eternally unchanging three sides. So you have this world of this very object-centric world where it's like, well, if it suddenly grows a fourth side, then it's not a triangle anymore. So the problem with focusing on this sort of Euclidean classical logic way of looking at the world is you end up with a world that doesn't change very much. Because as soon as something changes, then obviously it's no longer the thing, it's another thing. And in real life, and we call this processual ontology, which is a terrible name because it makes it sound like quantum physics or something, something that's alien and doesn't have any real relevance to our everyday lives. Now, the thing is, despite the weird name, actually, a lot of what we do in our lives and a lot of what we talk about in our lives is on this level. So, I meet a mate of mine who I know has joined a band recently. I don't ask him if the band good or bad. I say, how's the band going? He says, yeah, it's not so bad. We're getting together. Had a bit of problems at the start, but we're gelling. Things seem to be developing. It's looking okay. That's not telling me either A or not A. That's giving me an account of a process. Same thing, you know, we phone up family relative, you know, how's so-and-so doing getting over the loss of her aunt? So, well, it's hard at first, but you get along and so on. So you can see, the idea of telling stories about processes is actually part of our everyday life. It's part of, most of what we talk about, in fact, is in this register, rather than saying things are either A or not A. So despite the weird name and the stretchy concepts here, this is actually as much a part of our life as, you know, sort of 2 plus 2 equals 4 kind of area of eternal. So the thing that we're not going to talk about, because it would be a diversion, we don't have time, is Orthodox Marxism. However, the reason that it's still in the slide, even though we're not going to talk about it, is because that, you know, historically in the 20th century, Orthodox Marxism had a big hold and a big influence over workers' movements around the world, particularly in Western Europe and so on and so forth. So even though most people have maybe have heard of Marx, but certainly never read any Marx or have a particular idea of what Orthodox Marxism is, that doesn't mean that the imprint of that influence isn't left in people's ideas about class. And my assertion is that a lot of those sort of influence of those ideas was to think of class precisely as a thing, as a determinate thing, as a man in a flat cap, dungarees, and a spanner, and a union card. So just to resume what I'm proposing as a more useful way of looking at class, is that it's not a thing, it's not a place, or an event. It's not an identity, and that's quite important, which we'll get to in a bit. Nor is it a culture. People talk about work class culture, etc. That's nice, but, you know, what about a Nigerian taxi driver? Has he got a working class culture? Is his culture different for yours? Perhaps. Does that mean he's not working class? No. So you can't, you know, to create an identity-based or cultural basis for class means you're missing out something, which is about the content of your experience. Basically, we've got a couple circuits here. Right, we've got the circuit of capitalist production from the point of view of the capitalist. Starts off with money, and then with that money, he's going to buy things that are available to sell on the market, but he's particularly going to buy commodities, including labor power, that's people he's hiring, means of production, that's tools, instruments, and also raw materials and center materials that he's going to use under his or her direction in the process of production to turn that into products, which is then sold for more money. Hopefully this is more money than at the start, otherwise you go bust. But this basic cycle, money, commodities, production, more commodities, more money, is how the thing goes round from the capitalist point of view. Now then, we as labor have a different cycle, which is our reproductive cycle. So we start off with nothing. And it's the fact that we start here that's quite important, by the way. But what we have is we have our ability to work. So that's a commodity for sale on the market. We go out, we look for work. So we sell our labor park, and this comes into their cycle there. And that money that they spend on wages comes into our cycle here. So we go from selling our commodity labor power to getting some wages, which we then spend on rent, utility bills, food, things we need to live. Then we have to take all that stuff and do a certain amount of work. We have to cook the food, we have to clean the house, we have to go and get the shopping, blah, blah, blah. At the end of it all, we're back to scratch again. So that's how our circle goes around. Now, the conflict here, obviously, is this one here over the wage. So we're all kind of used to the fact that the less wages the capitalist pays us as workers, the more he makes. And from our own point of view, the more we can charge for workers, we can charge for our labor, the more we get. Now, that's fine, and that's kind of a well-understood part of that. But what I want to do, really, is look at the cycle again, a little on a different scale, or in a different area, if you like. Because the problem with that is that associates the whole class conflict process with what we call the immediate process of production, i.e. being a wage worker, going into work, and working. So that leaves out lots of people. Unemployed students, housewives, obviously there's not that many people. There's less women who are able to stay at home and only have one income coming into the house these days. But an unemployed, I've included single mothers as well in that category. That's to say, they would be unemployed, but they're still doing the work of looking after kids, etc. So even though, we have a lot of unemployment at the moment, even though a lot of so-called housewives would now be women who are doing the double shift, that's to say, working and then coming home and doing double shift and doing the child care and that kind of as well, that's still one category that normally would not be included in the immediate process of production. Self-employed, I mean, a certain amount of this is legal trickery. You know, a lot of people working construction trades are technically self-employed, even though, you know, you're still basically selling your labor to the man with the money. Kids and all this. What I want to do here is look again, and rather than taking the employed wage earner, which is, you know, sort of a story probably we're more familiar with, I want to look at the cycle of reproduction from the point of view of an unemployed single mother, so that if we can see from that where the conflicts come out from, where the struggles come out from. You start from here with nothing. The first stage in your cycle is the money. You're unemployed, you're not selling your labor. Therefore, the money, in most likelihood, is coming from the state, the social wage. You still have to get this. They're not keen on giving it to you. So already, straight away, to get that part of the process there, you're coming into conflict with benefit agencies and so on and so forth. The next problem is the stuff that you need, you know, sort of your commodities for your own reproduction, if you like, is not what you're going to be able to spend all your money on. Because coming out of here, you've got rent,
bills,
bin taxes, bills, etc.
Gas, electricity.
Also within here, you've got people playing around loan sharks. You're on welfare, you're short of money, you've got a birthday coming around. Loan sharks will be knocking on your door.
Credit union's not a bit more appropriate.
Sorry?
Credit union's appropriate
in the first stop. If you have credit union, yes. But if you don't, then these people are also a point of struggle, of problem. So that's simply just moving through the first stage of the cycle. You've got problems here. Now, the next stage of the cycle, the shopping, the getting the commodities, is people who live on estates where you've got no public transport to get to proper shops. You have to buy out of corner shops where the prices are jacked up. And there's a million and one ways. Basically, if you're a single mother living on the state with craft services, you're actually going to pay a lot more for the same commodities that other people who drive to the supermarket get, through no fault of your own, through your circumstances. Then, finally, you have to do the work of, and this is not just the work of looking after yourself, now this is the work of looking after the kids as well. So, you've got schools, service, social services. You're going to have dealings with all of these people, and some of those dealings are not going to be easy. You know, there's going to be a lot of various people within this system here, same as down with social benefits, are going to be judging you and putting obstructions in your way. Partly because it's their job to do so to save money, but partly for other cultural reasons as well. So, what I wanted to say, this is not a proper analysis. This is just an explanation of how, by looking at the circumstances, we can start to see where conflict arises within the process of living. And I say, this has got nothing to do with who you are. Doesn't matter whether you're white, you're black, doesn't matter whether you're Irish or Jamaican or whoever. This is, you know, roughly a map of the stuff that you have to deal with. Now then, obviously there are certain problems with struggles within sort of the sphere of reproduction, in the sense that you're kind of starting off almost on your own. So things can be very individual. And there are individual ways of sort of evading or bypassing these. You know, you've got shoplifting here. You've got various other methods here. So there are individual ways of dodging around this. Although obviously there's not many, because otherwise everyone would be doing them. Fixing your meter, blah, blah, blah. But for us, it only becomes interesting as a class thing when you sort of break out of the individual attempt to duck and dive and dodge your way around things and start thinking about collective ways of dealing with things that relate to the same people in your situation. So if you start getting together groups of people to say, okay, you know, let's fuck the loan sharks off and get a credit union, that sort of thing, that's a collective response to a problem that you all have. Same thing with commodities of like, well, you know, can we get a food co-op together, stuff like that. Wherever, and the same with schools and so on. And bills, for example, things like the bin tax, the water tax, and so on. Is there a way that people in the neighborhood can get together to resist the imposition of new taxes and so on? These are collective responses to points of struggle. And that, from our point of view, is sort of an instance of class development, if you like. So I wanted to go through that process basically because we've heard the story a lot of times about how capitalism and the class struggle is basically about the capitalists ripping off the wage worker. I wanted to give that as just an example of how we can look at the process of class and see how it brings into conflict and how at each point of those conflicts there are potentials for collective solutions, collective resistances. Right, the next thing that I wanted to talk about is the idea of, if class doesn't exist, would it be necessary to invent it? Or would it be useful to invent it? This is coming back to something that the Italian, sort of the Italian lefties in the 1960s who were trying to find an escape route from Orthodox Marxism started looking around, and their experiences, particularly in the factory as it happened, was to do with the introduction of new technology and what this meant, whereas the official Communist Party thing was new technology, great stuff. They go, no, this new technology is being used to break down our actual power over production lines and so on within the factory. So it's not neutral, it's actually hostile, it's part of the class struggle there. Anyway, through a long evolved process, which I won't go into too much, they came up with this idea of class composition, which is the idea that you have a physical composition, if you like, which is how people are employed within the economy and doing things. And that changes over time. And as that changes, this again is to get away from the idea of class being a thing that happened once in the 19th century and is basically unchanging ever since. They're talking about getting back to an idea of class as dynamic, that, you know, sort of the industries that we work in have changed. And as they change, this affects how people are, you know, work together in terms of their solidarity, their consciousness, new values coming in as the organic composition of capital changes. So they talked about the technical composition of the class, which is basically who's employed where, how is the world of work changes, how people become unemployed, etc., blah, 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 and the political composition, with the idea that as the technical composition of class changes, there is this process of decomposition. The idea of decomposition is that, like, capitalism obviously would love us all to believe that there's no such thing as a working class, we're all atomized individual consumers, and that we should do for all. So that's the sort of the ultimate goal of capitalism, if you like, is to say, you know, you're not working class, you're all middle class now, as Thatcher said. Enjoy it. Or at least, if you can't enjoy it, shut the fuck up. So the idea of decomposition is when traditions of class solidarity that go back to things that have been built up over previous years are broken down by changes in the technical composition and the way the society works, where people, you know, you can no longer get a job where your mother or your grandmother worked before because that factory's now shut. So all the solidarity that she grew up with and that her mother grew up with are just not there for you anymore. That's decomposition. The other side of things is recomposition, where people being brought together from more atomized backgrounds through working together or through being active together in social spaces or in through any other walk of life, through music, through culture, through shared interests, any sort of thing that will bring them together, start to evolve a bit of an autonomous culture that rejects at least some of the ideas, the dominant values of capitalist culture, and start to get this idea of having some antagonistic values and some kind of interest that is not in the dominant government interest, what have you. So those are the ideas of class composition that can be usefully articulated in a more dynamic view of class rather than something that arose in the 19th century and has remained unchanging ever since. So that more or less brings me to the conclusion. Because I've been talking long enough, and it would be much more interesting to hear some discussion here. I want to return to the question, what use is it? What use is the concept of class? Here I bring up my rocket slide. Class is not, despite all the big words I've thrown at you so far, class is not actually that complicated if you think about it. I remember someone asking me, saying, like, how come whenever anything comes up, whether it's, you know, Shell to Sea, the Bin Tax, the Water Tax, or something like, all the lefty groups, they all say the same thing. It's like, well, it's not really surprising, is it? I mean, when things like the Water Tax come up and so on, it's like, is that a class issue? Yeah, pretty much. Is it any surprise then that all the lefty groups say pretty much the same thing? Not really. It would be a bit surprising if they didn't in some ways. So it's that idea of, like, you don't need a PhD or a special piece of equipment to detect when things are a class issue, because it becomes pretty obvious. Everybody goes, no, this is an attack on our living standards. It's obviously in favor of the process of transferring wealth from ordinary people to the rich. Simple as. What use is it? Well, the other thing that I wanted to go into, actually, the problems of operating within the community sphere is whereas there's a problem within the workplace that you tend to be segmented along your industrial lines, so you have bus workers looking down on social workers and hairdressers not too pleased with doctors and so on and so forth. This sectoral divisions, if you like. When you're working within the neighborhood, people tend to reach out first and foremost to the people that they have most either that they're related to or they have most affinity to culturally and so on and so forth. So you can get this problem of a communitarian type of network going on, which can exclude people who are not from the dominant cultural sort of identity and so on. So again, these wherever we organize, there are always these problems of looking out for divisions that are potentially there. So one of the usefulness of the class, if you like, is to try and make us think about social struggles in terms that are not just based on our identity, that they're actually based on seeing that people from entirely different backgrounds from ourselves can actually have the same circumstances as that we're living through, and that basically, regardless of whatever cultural differences we have common problems and common enemies, and that's the, sort of, for me, the basis of a class composition, if you like, the transcending of identity. And the final piece of utility is, well, the end of class. It would be nice to get rid of class. Obviously, it would be nice to get rid of system of exploitation where the majority of people's lives are made miserable for the furtherance of profit. And I personally can't see a way that we're going to do that without having the large majority of people acting together on some level or another to radically change things. And I think the only sort of point of unity that we can actually get people from all sorts of different backgrounds, cultures, and so on, and ethnicities together on a common purpose, if you like, on a common mission, is around class.
Thanks, Paul. Just before I start taking questions and discussion, a lot of you, I think, this might be your first time in Showmas Free, so it's one sort of project that aims at creating an autonomous space, as well as us using it for meetings at Choosebuy, Shelter Sea, Choice Islands. So it's a lot of kind of social events and things like that.
The recording you've been listening to was a recording from the Rethinking Revolution discussion series in Showmas Spree. That particular topic was how do we know who will struggle. We also recorded the discussion that followed the presentation. You can find that file at www.wsm.ie. Recording and editing was done by Andrew Flood. For additional recordings, see the WSM website at www.wsm.ie.